Jo Muirhead, and this is the Entrepreneurial Clinician Podcast, a podcast for health professionals who want to know how we continue to serve our patients and our clients without sacrificing ourselves to the work. More than a conversation on making money or just burning out, this podcast has been created to progress conversations that we need to have to ensure that we know who we are so that we can serve those who need our help, so that we can actually be the significant difference in the world. Welcome to the Entrepreneurial Clinician Podcast. I am Jo Muirhead, your host, and we are into season three. Yay for season three. My guest today is Amber Hawley, and we are talking into a topic that I think is necessary and important. And some of you are going to go, but Jo, this topic is being done to death. We are going to be talking into neurodiversity. But before you switch off and go, oh my God, I know everything there is to know about neurodiversity, I encourage you to do two things. The first thing is, if you've got children listening with you, turn this off, because chances are you're going to hear some foul language. You have been warned. The second thing is, you can't possibly know everything there is to know about neurodiversity. So stop deceiving yourself, you know, opinionated Joe. Spend the next 30 minutes with us. And my challenge to you is to find the one piece of information that you didn't know, didn't expect, or that you can now use in your health practice. We ready to go? Amber, are you ready to go? Did you like that intro?
I'm ready to go. And I love it. Yes. That was why the warning, because I like spicy language.
Yeah. And I'm not going to try and ask you to be something that you're not. But I just think it's fair to warn other people in case we both end up on that side of the page. Amber, who are you and what is it that you bring to this world?
Yes. Well, thanks for having me on. I'm excited. So I'm Amber Hawley. I'm a licensed therapist by trade, and I'm a former dot-commer. I like to say I'm an ENFP with ADHD. I'm a dot-com dropout, so how I say it. But I would say a majority of my time is spent helping neurospicy, I like to call it that, but neurodivergent or neurodiverse business owners get shit done. And also in sustainable ways. Like, I'm a big systems person, so it's very much like burnout prevention and a lot of self-acceptance around the fact that our brains work a little differently and they aren't always built for the neurotypical world.
Yes. I'm thrilled to have you on this podcast. We've known each other for a while, so we've got really high trust here. We also have a lot of respect for each other. So the way you turn up in the world, and I guess we've kind of watched each other's careers over the last almost 10 years. And even though we've been on, yeah, I know, 2015 was when we met.
Yeah. I knew that. I was like, wow, it's just amazing how fast time goes, right?
Yeah. And at that time, when I first met you, I was so impressed that you were a dot-com dropout that decided to become a health professional or a mental health professional. Can you help me understand, unpack that a bit, help people understand how you made that career change?
Yeah. Well, like most 27-year-olds, I had an existential crisis. That's the sarcasm part. I think I was always meant to be a therapist. It was something I was really interested in. I remember in like high school, it was like be a lawyer or be a psychologist. Those were like the two things that were like in my like purview of what I was interested in. And, you know, I have so much love and respect for the dot-com world, or, you know, because I worked in Silicon Valley. I lived in Silicon Valley for 22 years. And yet I had this point where I was like, what am I doing? Like, if the world were to end tomorrow, would my job matter? Would, you know, creating this website or whatever matter? And I think there is value in all of that stuff. So it's not saying somebody who creates websites doesn't have value. It was for me personally, I felt like there's something else I'm supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to go back to school and was really exploring it. And then it was just like, yeah, going back to the thing, what are you good at? people have always told me their stories. People always confide in me, like things they're saying, and they like, I've never told anyone this. And I was like, I might as well get paid for this part because like they just naturally, I've been getting it since I was young, like very, very young. And I love it. And cause I actually got to the point in the, when, you know, in the particular company that I worked at where I was like, I began to hate people. I was like, that's where I said, I'm like, everyone sucks. I hate them. And I realized, no, it was just like, I didn't like the corporate structure. It just didn't work for me. And it was like, I love connecting with people. It was just that I didn't like that it wasn't like authentic and it wasn't, I don't know. It just didn't feel like genuine connection always, right? So that was the part that I struggled with.
Wow. So you took yourself back to school as a 27-year-old. Okay. So you incurred some debt, I'm assuming.
Oh, yeah. Of course. Yeah. Because I mean, I was paying for it myself. And the thing is, like, well, this is part of my neurospicy journey. Even though I was very smart and like I skipped my senior year and got like a free year of college because of the program we had in my school, I did not know I was ADHD. I did not find out until I was like 40, 41. And it was after I met you. I didn't even know when I met you that I had ADHD. Yeah. And I like struggled with so many things. And I had, you know, there was a lot of life stuff happening. And so I ended up just like going full time working in like retail and then being a nanny. And so I actually went back to school and got my bachelor's first at 27 and then went straight to grad school. So yeah, so it was just because I had to pay for myself. Like I had to live on my own. I moved out at 18. So, you know, that's it. It was like, okay, I wasn't ready. And I'm glad I waited because I wasn't ready until I was. And then it was like, oh, I'm doing this. Like, this is the thing, right?
Yeah. So you've now disclosed to the world that you know you have ADHD. What does that mean? So let's just get back to some basics here, right? Like, what is this thing, this phenomenon that we now read about or hear about neurodivergence or neurodiversity? What is it? What does it mean?
Yeah, I guess I'll just like in a general way, I'm not going to break down like a DSM diagnosis for anybody.
Oh, please don't. Go, please don't.
Yeah, I was like, because that's boring shit. No, I'm not going to do it. So.
No, please don't.
So I like to say, well, it's really about there are these spectrum of things in which, that's why I say neurospicy, because I feel like we all have our little own little blend and recipe. Like sometimes we fit, you know, like some people you meet, they might be ADHD, but they might have these autistic traits and they might have this other stuff, but it's a collection of thing of ways people's brains work differently, right? So there's neurotypical and it's like your brain works in this way and it's kind of like accepted. I feel like the neurospicy brain, it operates differently. And so it perceives time differently. It perceives like sometimes there's like studies to show this with like when you look at brain scans, when a neurospicy person, an ADHD person tries to focus on something, the harder they try to focus, their brain actually, like they show the brain doesn't focus. It actually is diffuse. So like there's this difficulty in, I feel like we're in negotiation with our brain all the time. Like that's what it is.
Oh, what a great way to explain it. Keep going.
Okay, good. I was like, I'm like, is this going to be the most like non-professional way to explain something?
Well, let me give you a chance to take a breath and regather your thoughts around it. Because my private practice, Purple Co, we meet people, we've been working with people whose brains don't work the same way as my brain ever since we started. And right. And one of my career disappointments, I guess, has been that for so many years, we were supposed to treat these people to make their brains work differently, right? And I've never subscribed to that because there's only so much we can do. And then I started investigating it more and looking at the different ways that a neurospicy person operates. And I started to learn so much about, well, I now call them neurospicy hacks. I've got many. I'm not like, I do not fit on the spectrum. You know, seriously, no, you wouldn't find me in any of those categories. That's okay. I tried. It didn't work. That's not what's going on with my brain. But I have gleaned so much from a neurospicy way of thinking and some of the hacks and the time management and the focus and the locus of control stuff that I'm like, maybe you guys have got it right and we've got it wrong. So then thinking on my practice and how we were encouraged to treat these conditions, and I'm like, don't like it. So my philosophy has very much adopted the, how do I help a neurospicy person make sense of themselves in a neurotypical world? So that's kind of my philosophy. And that's the, anybody on my team, on my purple coat team, would have that philosophy. We don't try and make a neurospicy person non-neurospicy anymore. But there's still some shame and guilt, maybe parental guilt attached to a child or an adult coming out with this diagnosis. What was that like for you? You said you didn't get diagnosed until you were 40.
Yeah. Well, first I just want to say, like, I think there would be such a substantial difference if people would take your philosophy, like, to understand, because it's, that would be like saying, I'm going to make this gay person not gay. Like,
yeah.
Let me figure out how to fix them. There's nothing to fix. That's the way they are. This is the way our brains are. Right. And there's, you know, just to touch on, so there's like ADHD, autism, OCD, dyslexia, dyspraxia, bipolar, HSP. Like, those are all things. I just threw out a bunch of abbreviations because we don't have time to say full words. But just to say, like, there's a big collection of, you know, things that people's brains just work differently, right? And so, like, this acceptance of, that's why it's neurodiversity. There's a diverse way in which people's brains work. And if we can let go of the idea that all brains work in this one way, in this neurotypical way, as that being the right way, it would be so transformative to people, because there is a ton of shame. The people who are neurospicy, it kind of gets instilled in them because they're not doing it right, right? Like, there's this idea of, well, if you just tried harder, or what I hear, and I would say it to myself all the time, I hear it all the time from business owners, like, if I just did it better, like, if I just did it better, I could make this work. And I'm like, no, because that's not the way your brain works. And it's so much easier to adapt the tactic to fit how your brain works. Like, that's where the magic is, right? Because there's all this good stuff that comes with being neurospicy too. But there are inherent challenges. So I think that would be so transformative. And I'm a couples therapist. Was my specialty in therapy is couples. And the statistic is that couples will go to an average of 6 people before the person will get the diagnosis to understand that they have ADHD, or have a person, a couples therapist, who has enough knowledge to not be telling them to do things that don't work for for a neurodiverse person. And so, again, like, and unfortunately, you know, when you talk about forgetfulness or attention or hyperfocusing, you know, things that come with being ADHD, obviously that impacts a relationship, because people will perceive it as like, you don't care about me, I'm not a priority, when it's, that may absolutely not be true at all. It's just like, how do we address that? So I think it's such a, I mean, just that your philosophy would be so transformative, because I come across a lot of even therapists, which you would hope they would know better, where it's just this value judgment, this is the right way. And I think we have so many value judgments. And I see, unfortunately for us, you know, especially people diagnosed later in life, but I think for everyone, there is a value judgment of, I'm not supposed to be this way. This is the right way to do things. The right way is to get up and be at work at 8 a.m. and work until 5 and do X, Y, Z. And it's like, that doesn't work for me. So I've got to figure out, you know, what does, right?
Wow. I just heard the shame-based statements that, oh God, if I have done that to any of my past clients because I was still learning, I apologize right now. But just that whole, I'm not supposed to be this way. Like that's just knowing that there's something inherently wrong with me. I don't know what it is. I don't know how to fix it. Don't know how to talk about it. Don't know where to go for it. And everywhere I go, like up to 5 couples therapists that I've gone to are all reinforcing to me and my partner that there's something inherently wrong with me. What that's mean. I'm just sorry. That's just mean.
Well, you know, and I'm in the productivity space. You know, I do systems and like I said, help people get shit done. And in the productivity space, it's the same thing. I would come across these experts, and I've met so many productivity experts who are ADHD, which I love. Yeah. And so there's very thoughtful ones, right? But then there's some where I met this person and they're like, well, when it's painful enough, you'll do it. And I was like, sister, you do not understand anything, because like, that's, it's like my brain says, hold my beer. It could be the most painful, awful thing. You can see your life crumbling and you still cannot get yourself to do that thing. And there is nothing more shameful or awful, especially being a high achieving person, right? Like that's, you know, it's even, I mean, I think for anyone who's ADHD, but like having, not feeling like you are in control of your brain all the time, or like this, why can't I do this? It's so important, you know, and it's hard. The shame is a lot. I will say getting diagnosed, when I finally got diagnosed, it was such a relief, because I thought all of these things that I thought were character defect or deficits were really ADHD symptomology, because I didn't understand how to approach it. And had I known, I would have given myself the help I needed, right? And so I thought, oh, well, this is why I'm just a shitty person. Or, you know, a lot of people hear a lot like, oh, you're lazy. And yet we're some of the most hardworking, motivated people I know, but we're having to work extra, extra hard. So we will like overwork and then like crash, overwork and then crash, because you know, it just, it's called masking. To show up in the neurotypical world like most people do takes an inexorbitant amount of energy. So yeah, I think it's, I think that's the tragedy of it all. And so I just wish there was more like understanding and acceptance, and not just value judging, like, oh, well, you're lazy, or, oh, you obviously, you know, don't care because you're not doing this one thing. And it's like, you, oh, people care deeply.
Yeah, absolutely.
They can't activate.
Yeah. And we know that that rejection sensitivity is incredibly heightened for neurospicy people, because you're working so the way I'm picturing it right now is your brain is working so hard to be like me, be like Joe, be like a neurotypical person. So I just turn up and I get to do the things in a neurotypical way. You have to expend a lot of energy to turn up on time, to remember what it is that we were talking about.
I was like, Joe, I'm going to take you down. I'm going to take you down.
I know. It's all right.
Joe was on time. It took 30 seconds for Zoom to let me in. And I get a message that comes through at 6:01. I'm like, I was on time, Joe. 1 minute is not late.
Oh God. And for those of you who can't see me right now, the blush in me is huge, because my anxiety is making sure that I'm on time. So if I'm not 10 minutes early, I feel like I'm 10 minutes.
I know. I knew it. I knew it when you commented the last time. And I was like, I will say, I was like, she's one of those people who believes 10 minutes early. That is a value judgment. And again, like I, you know, I love you, so it's, I can give you a hard time. But I will say, like, when you did that, and I was like, oof, you just set a tone for me. Now I feel like on the defense, and I feel like I have to prove myself. When I was on time, it was like, I'm not 10 minutes early, because I don't believe that that's on time. I think that's a bullshit construct. Time is a construct, right? So it's like, why would I say like that's the right way, when it's like we all have different definitions? So, you know, I'm not, you know, I'm taking
no, but I think this is a perfect example of this conversation that needs to be had, just about something as simple as, you know, my parents' generation would, and I heard this, if you're not on time, you're lazy, you're lazy, you're lazy, you're lazy, you're lazy. And then it turned into you're disrespectful, you're disrespectful, you're disrespectful, you're disrespectful. So I, as a young age, got terrified that if I wasn't on time, I wasn't the good girl. If I wasn't the good girl, the love would be withdrawn from me. So that's
exactly.
Yeah. So I've now brought that into my adulthood. So somebody like yourself who's driven by appointments to see clients, I take that value judgment with me wherever I go. So already, automatically, if me turning up 10 minutes early and then getting anxious and fidgety waiting for the person to turn up, and they might be 2 minutes late, like, who cares? But I'm already setting a tone in that session that tells that client, it's not okay for you to be like this.
Yes. Yeah. And then it's like, we either have to. Yeah. Then it's like, I have to overperform, or I'm defensive and irritated. And then my brain is focusing on that instead of the thing it's supposed to be doing and talking about. And it's always kind of playing there. And the thing is, it's like, okay, then, you know, then it's like, learn to manage your anxiety, because you know, it's that, that's where you get defensive and you feel that like that's your, yes. that's on you. Like, but to understand, and again, like I do, I believe I'm being on time because I do run my life by appointments. I am back to back to back in appointments. So I would never be 10 minutes early because I'm still finishing up my last appointment. Like, cause I, that's how I do it. But I do agree. Like, I do think there's a time in which it's egregious and it's disrespectful. And if it's like consistently like that, so I do think that there's like conversations to be had. I think it can feel, cause you know, when like, again, I log into Zoom and I'm just waiting for Zoom to come in where you feel like helpless. Like, well, now I'm 1 minute late and now I'm in the lazy, not worthy person category. Whereas somebody else can show up like, you know, 30, 45 minutes late. Like, I get that. I get that. I get 15, you know, even that, like it's hard and it's so ingrained in us. And that's why, you know, I appreciate you saying that. Like, some people are taught that, other people are taught like, you know, if you're within 5 minutes, you're totally good. Like, everybody's taught differently, but it's like, we think our way is the right way. And that's how everyone should be. That's a value judgment, right? Like, I'm not saying you're right or wrong. I'm just saying that's how it is.
This episode of the Entrepreneurial Clinician Podcast is brought to you by Purple Co's Activating Resilience Program. This 8-week program is foundational for anyone who wants to develop a genuine practice of resilience. I asked Activating Resilience co-creator and coach Kylie Worry to share how this program has helped transform her world. Here's what she had to say.
Many, many years ago, when I learned about this model of building resilience, I was so burned out and so tired. I was so overwhelmed and I was looking for a bright light in a very dark place. I found that light and it gave me some amazing tools to use with my clients. Tools that helped me feel lighter, more empowered, and get better results with my clients. What I didn't realize was how this tool would support me in my own life to look at my own resources and how to know how to support myself when facing adversity. This tool has supported me to shift my mindset when facing adversity to look for the solution, to have a hope for a better outcome, rather than being stuck in the problem. So many gifts have come from learning about this model for activating resilience. It's so much more than a tool to use in your business or with your clients. It's a tool for life.
For more information about the Activating Resilience program, check the show notes or go to purpleco.com.au/activating-resilience. And I just wanted to use the example of something that was so often ignored. I mean, how often do we have a discussion with a new client about, so how do you turn up for, like, how do you manage time without it coming across? How do you manage time, says the important person with all the power in the room, right? Because how those discussions never come up. I don't think I've ever had that. Actually, that's not true. Those discussions I have with my men, usually men or people with brain injuries, because I know that they're not turning up.
Right. Like, right. And there's a justifiable reason when you know they have that, right? Like, so that's the thing where, and it's interesting you say that though, because like I stopped working with a practitioner. She was a chiropractor and I'm sorry. Yeah, not a chiropractor. She was an acupuncturist and I loved her and I thought she was amazing. And, I would see her or the owner of the practice and it just depended on the day, but your appointment lasts for a certain period of time. And, you know, like it would be like going to a massage therapist. Your appointment is 50 minutes. If you come late, you get a shorter massage. I'm willing to accept that consequence if I'm late to something. I would never expect somebody to change, like adjust to accommodate me. But this person, you could tell she, like if I was like 5-10 minutes late, she was very irritated. And I'm like, you know, it was the Bay Area traffic. And I'm just like, why do you care? I'm paying you. It takes you the same amount of time. I'm not expecting more. Why are you irritated? Like that bothered me. And I was like, I just can't deal with that shit. So I just stopped seeing her. I'm like, yeah. I need to be with somebody who understands. Like, why does it matter? I do get like, if you're like, because, you know, even as a therapist, if like clients come late, habitually and then they expect me to give them extra time, that's a very different conversation, right?
Yeah,
but if they can come and say, I know we're done, like, or they can acknowledge it, or we had that conversation at one time, then it's like, I feel no pressure to have to accommodate them. That's wonderful, right? Those are small ways that we can learn, like you said, talk about it and figure out what works.
And don't be afraid to have somebody point out your own flaws to you. Like, knowing my time, my relationship with time is so much a construct of me being an anxious person. How is that any, that's the way my brain works. It's not always positive. It's not always helpful, but it's no different to a neurospicy person who has a different way of managing time. And if we're going, rather than colliding and butting heads, it's like, how do we make this work? So most of my coaching clients, this is one of the conversations I have with them early on. It's like, if you're going to be late, you just need to tell me. Just work it out. And then I've got this gorgeous neurospicy person in my world. Her name is Amaret Kaufman. She has taught me so much. She's a part of a mastermind that I run. And she just blanketly said, I find turning up on time really hard. It's not because I don't care. It's something I don't like, but it's something that happens. And once she said that to us, we all just went, cool. So if she turns up late, we're like, hey, it's great you're here. It's just great you're here.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So having that conversation, but not everybody's that accepting, but I think it's great. And yeah, I know I work with Amaret too. I love her. And sometimes having that conversation. And again, this, I don't want this to sound defensive because I'm not trying to be, but to explain, as a therapist, we know there are things you can do for anxiety. There are strategies as an ADHD person that we can do too. So I'm not trying, we all have accountability, but at a certain point, the way our brains work is like, we can't change that. We can have conversations, we can accommodate. And I'm not saying you should be late. Like, I do believe in being on time, right? And so
the being on time thing is the example we're using today, Amber. We could have chosen a gazillion things, but this one came up naturally.
We could have. But it's a good one because it's probably one of the most common. But it's also that time blindness. So like, even I'll work with people and say, like I've done this too, where I'm sitting there waiting for an appointment and I was like, oh, okay. So I start working. We hyper-focus. So that's the irony, right? It's not that we don't have attention. It's that we don't always control our attention. And when we're really into something, we hyper-focus. And that's where we get amazing amounts of things done in a short period of time. And if we're not interested in something, it's like climbing Everest, being unprepared, right? Like, it's very hard to focus. And so, you know, I've sat there and then all of a sudden I'm late. I'm actually late because I missed my reminder goes at 10 minutes before. And then I'm sitting there and I don't click that button to go into Zoom. So after that happened, I was like, okay, so now what I do is, as soon as I'm done with one meeting, I get into Zoom and I'm there. That way the ding comes when my client or whoever I'm meeting with, like when they show up, I get that notification, right? Because that's the thing where you're like, time can slip away. So that's my responsibility as an ADHD person to figure out those hacks, right?
So tell me more about this hyper-focused time blindness thing, because this is another thing. I know parents get cranky with this. It's like, I've told him to set alarms. He just ignores them. It's like working with some of my clients is like they forget that they've got memory aids. So like we have all of these value judgments coming from their OTs and then other medical people going, they just need memory aids. And I'm like, doesn't help if you forget how to use your memory aids. It's a bigger problem than that. So talk to me about time blindness or the hyper-focus and how, like, because to me, that the outcome of that as a neurotypical person would be, well, you're just friggin' lazy. You're unmotivated and you're lazy. Like, I can see how I could form that judgment, but you're telling me that it's the opposite?
Well, I mean, I guess... there are lazy people out there. They're not all ADHD. There are just lazy people out there. But actually, I always loved when I first started seeing a therapist in my 20s, and she said, you're unmotivated. And I was like, ooh, I like that. Like, it's unmotivated. But even then, it wasn't even that. Because then after understanding ADHD, I'm like, I am motivated. It's just like shit happens, right? But that's the thing where, yeah, like I think, well, one, I'm going to answer your question, but I want to answer this one first because I think you had mentioned it maybe even before we started recording. What people could do is just ask a question, like what's getting in the way or what's happening that this wasn't able to happen, right? Like helping them kind of figure out like how, just telling them this is the way you do it, as opposed to let me understand what's happening, what's the process, so we can kind of figure out what is a good trigger. Like I said, the normally yes. if I'm like, if I happen to come right on time and then I'm sitting there and I see the clock and I log in at time, but if sometimes when I'm early and then I get into something, it literally is time blindness. Like you just don't realize time has passed. So it's figuring out like, how do I accommodate for that? Or how can we do it in a more creative, different way? But we still expect people to show up and do things and, you know, like take care of life, but they have to approach it often very differently.
Yeah.
So the hyper-focus, well, I have so many examples like this. There was one, what was I working? I think I was working on taxes because the tax extension deadline was coming up. Because for those of us ADHD people, we're not talking April 15th here. We're talking like, I think it was like, was it October 22nd or so? I don't know. Like when you have to have given your taxes finally after filing an extension, right? So I was doing like tax stuff. And I started working. I had a full day of clients, but of course I waited till the end because again, activation, it's almost like we don't have a starter switch sometimes when it's something dreadful.
Ah.
We don't have a starter. Sometimes we don't have a finisher, but if we're into something, we can start and go in. But once we get started, we can hyper-focus. I actually like numbers. I'm good at numbers, but like the idea of taxes just sounds so dreadful, even though I pay a CPA. So I started working on it and I was going through and then I started going through my budgets and going through all different kinds of things. And then all of a sudden I heard a noise in like the hallway. Cause I think my husband was sick. So he was sleeping upstairs and I was in our room and I was like, oh, what, one of the kids is up, like what's going on? And I'm like, are you okay? Like kind of yelled out, like, are you okay? What's going on? They were getting ready for school. I had stayed up all night and I didn't even realize it. Like I got so roast in it. it was literally 6 something. Like
In the morning.
And that is not the only time that has happened. And that was just last year. I mean, it's not like this, you know, and I'm 48. Like it's like this still happens where sometimes you just get so engrossed into it, you just like time ceases to exist, right? So I do things and have strategies to make sure, will it work 100% of the time? No, because I'm a human, not a robot, so it won't, but there are things that you can do. But that's what happens in that hyper-focus. The good side of that is when you're doing a project or you have a lot of work to do, you can deep dive into it and get it done in like a day that would take other people 3-4 weeks, right? So there's an upside, but there's a cost to that as well.
One of the ways I've helped people in their workplaces who can get a lot done in a very, very short space of time, but then they do the crash and burn because nobody can maintain that level of focus and energy without there being a consequence, right?
Yes, 100%.
So helping their employer understand that the way to get the best out of this person is to give them projects. Don't give them open-ended things to get done. You need to give them a project style way of working. And for that particular person at that particular role, once we worked out, instead of them being a 9-to-5 person, then the jobs just went on and on and on and on and on and on ad nauseam. We went, right, you've got a project to complete. This is the start date. This is the end date. These are the resources you've got. This is the expectation that you got. So we took it away from time and turned it into function. And oh my God, their performance went through the roof. Like,
yes. And yes, like you're saying, there's a couple pieces to that. One is like, again, working in Silicon Valley, so many people like engineers or, you know, all different kinds of professionals, but they have these big projects or deadlines. But then there was this feeling of they would show up to work. I have to be there at 9. And literally they couldn't focus, one, because the work environment they were in, they're sitting in open cubicles, terrible for people with ADHD. And then it was like, they, you know, the brain's not online. They're doing, they basically would start work around 5 p.m. when everyone would like start to leave or whatever. And so then they ended up working until like 9 at night or 10 at night. And so they were working so long that that's, you know, really draining. And so to understand that sometimes they're overworking because their environment isn't supporting them, or like, or the time of day isn't supporting them. And like you said, it's like, you, if you take that away. Now, I would say I would never give a giant project and say, okay, it's due in 2 months. I would have check-in deadlines.
Yeah, yeah.
For, and like, we did deliverables. That sort of stuff. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So because it's like, you need that. That's a difference. It's such a different thing. And that's the one thing I did like about the dot-com world is, now there are some places where people are working and the expectation is 9. Often it was like, hey, you know, most, if you're there by 11, it's great. And I was like, awesome. Like I'll work late at night. And when I started my business, I started, well, once at first I was only working on the weekends, and during the day, which wasn't ideal, but that's when I had childcare. And then I was able to switch. I started seeing clients at 1 p.m. and I would see clients till 9, and it was great for me, because then I didn't have all that pressure and stress of the morning and just feel constantly behind. Because even if I wake up at 7, I don't want to talk to people at 7 or 9. Like, that's not where I'm at, you know? And everybody's different. I know ADHD people who love to get up at 4 or 5. Yeah. Everyone is different. There's no one brain for, you know, even ADHD, autism, anything. I think we think of like movie characters, like the, you know, and oh, that's what that looks like. It's like, no.
No, and that's an important thing to bring up. I think for those of us who don't live in a neurospicy world, that's kind of the only pattern that we've got is figures, the movie figures. And they haven't been represented accurately. Let's just put it that way. Amber, this has been such an important, I feel like we could talk. We say this every time we get on and talk to each other.
I know. I feel like I have 14 other things to say.
No, I know. Yes. So I will have you back so you can talk about the 14 other things. So if you could give health professionals of any discipline a piece of advice to help them become more, I don't want to say accepting, but more making neurodiverse people feel more like, I belong here, I can get the treatment here. What's one thing that we can be doing that just might set a different tone and not one of judgment and shame?
Yeah, my brain goes to, I guess, two places. I'm trying to think what would be the most helpful. I think anytime you're presenting them with information and like checking it sound, does that seem like something that would work for you? Like even asking it in that way, because there are times where I work with clients and I'm like, I know this is the thing, this is the right thing. How we make that happen might look a little bit different, but I, you know, there are some truths, right? Like that we understand, I don't know if like example would be better, but I think like just asking so that it doesn't feel like this is the only way. And if you don't do it this way, that means you're a broken person and you're wrong and you're, and it's hopeless. Like you're never going to get help, because this is what I hear from people all the time. And they're like, look, I just had a client say, there is no system that's ever going to work for me. So I just have to work harder. And I'm like, I was like, that sucks. And it's not true. It's not true. Right. But it's that's kind of the place. I think maybe this is what I would say. I'm such a clinician in this regard. I would talk to them. If you're having things come up for you, or you're feeling like they're being resistant, sometimes you think being resistant and they're not on board and whatever, and you talk to them and find out there was one thing they just couldn't move past to do the thing, to execute the thing. And if you, by talking to them and letting them like name it or identify it or even not feel shame about it, it allows them to actually implement your advice or the support you're trying to give them. But often that's what happens is we're like mentally, it's like we're like, okay, this is where I'm supposed to go. And then there's like, oh, this, and it's like this roadblock that you can't get past. And if you don't talk about it, so I think just talking to people more and trying to understand where they're coming from, you know, like it makes a difference. Cause like I said, you know, I have people like I'm like, you have to have a schedule. And I know I'm telling ADHD people to have a schedule. That's the last thing we want. And I'm like, but I know you need it. Like, and like, let's figure out, let's create one that you want to actually execute, right?
Yes.
Or you need task management software. Yeah.
Yeah, there we go.
All right, go ahead.
And it's not, don't do this, people. You need task management software. Here's a link to Asana. Don't do that.
Especially because Asana is horrible. Yes exactly.
Let's have a look at three or four that you might like. And then they get overwhelmed by choice, right? Potentially. And you go,
yes,
cool.
Yes.
Which features of which one do you like the most? Which one do you hate? Let's get rid of the one you hate. So we end up having to work with them. So it's not a, what I love is I don't have to have all the answers. I just create the space for the answers to come. And it's something yes. as concrete as let's create a schedule that we know you're going to want to stick to. I know yes, you need exactly. to get to work. You're telling me having this job is important. So let's work out a way that you can get to work on time. Because if you keep turning up 2 hours late, your boss is going to sack you. So how do we make this work?
Exactly.
That was not the short thing that I thought we were going to do.
No, I know. I'm sorry.
That's cool. All right. I'm going to wrap this up now. So it's obvious that we've got more to say. So Amber will be coming back. She didn't know that until just then. So Amber, when we finally get to be in real life, in real space again, we're having a coffee together. What am I ordering for you?
For me? Well, it would either be black coffee or an oat milk cappuccino.
Beautiful. Those I can do. I can actually.
I was like, is that a real question? I was like, did I misunderstand the question?
That's the real question. That's how everybody knows this episode's ending.
That's black coffee.
Black coffee or an oat milk cappuccino. I can do that.
Yes.
Very cool. Amber, if people want to learn more about how they can be supported by you or the resources and tools that you have available, where can they find you?
Yes. I have a podcast called The Easily Distracted Entrepreneur and another one that just launched called The Easily Distracted Therapist, if you happen to be a therapist. If you're listening to a podcast, you probably like podcasts. Otherwise, amberholly.com, or if to see the breadth of work, because, you know, it's very hard to focus, stilldistracted.com is a great place because it touches on all the different types of work.
That's really cool. Oh, I'm going to go find that. We will have those resources and links in the show notes for you. You can come and find Amber and I on social media. Make sure that you check her out. Even if you're not neurodiverse and you're not neurospicy, you have so much to learn to help your practice become more inclusive, more accessible. And you know what? You're probably going to learn a few things to help you too. Yep, opinion from Joe. Take it or leave it. But yeah, no, I've been around for a while now, people. Okay, this has been the Entrepreneurial Clinician Podcast. Until next time, go be your awesome self. And that is another episode of the Entrepreneurial Clinician Podcast done. Just want to say a big thank you to all the people who make this podcast possible. To all of my guests, a big thank you for sharing your time, your energy, your wisdom with me and my community. You are greatly appreciated. To Debbie and Jen, thank you for making this possible. And in the spirit of respect, please ask for and receive permission before you use any of my intellectual property. Because you know what? Not giving appropriation to creators is just not cool. Until next episode, go be your awesome self. Oh, and by the way, please make sure you subscribe, rate, and leave me a review so that other people are able to find this podcast. That's kind of important. Go do that.